The bubonic plague wiped out millions, but scientists and historians have long debated the cause. Was it the same bacterium that causes the plague today? Or was it anthrax or a virus? This hour, we'll talk about new DNA detective work helping to search for the truth by screening the skeletons of English victims for traces of the culprit. Plus, you may make decisions based on a gut feeling, but how much does your gut really influence your brain? Well, a lot, it turns out, if you're a mouse. We'll talk about how eating probiotic bacteria actually chilled out anxious mice. Time to stock up on that yogurt. And a primordial star that should not exist, according to a theory, but it does. How to explain. Some answers and your questions after the break. Stay with us. No need to be locked down to your laptop. You can take Science Friday with you. Find our apps in the iTunes Store and the Android Marketplace so you can really take this show and shove it right into your pocket. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You might have heard probiotic bacteria help keep your gut healthy, but could they be good for your brain too? A study out this week suggests the answer is yes, at least for mice, because mice on a probiotic diet for a couple of weeks were more relaxed than their counterparts who were not. They showed fewer visible signs of anxiety, lower levels of stress hormones, even chemical changes in the brain. Sounds a little like Valium, doesn't it? Other than signals telling you when you're hungry or full, what connection is there between the intestinal tract and the brain? And why would it be there? And all you yogurt lovers out there are probably wondering, is there any chance this finding might hold true for humans? Well, we'll talk about it. If you'd like to, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. You can tweet us at SciFry, S-C-I-F-R-I. Go to our website and talk over there, or you go to our Facebook page, /SciFry. My next guest is an author of that probiotic study, published this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. John Cryan is a professor at University College Cork in Ireland, and he joins us by phone. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Cryan.
Thank you very much, Ira. It's good to be on.
This sounds amazing. You fed the lab animals of probiotics, and why would they have any effect on the brain?
Well, I mean, it's been long known that the brain and the gut communicate, as you mentioned, in terms of feelings of hunger, etc. And so what's becoming clearer over the last while is that this brain-gut communication, or gut-brain, is a bidirectional communication, but also that the microbiota within, which is the gut flora within the gut, can actually also play an important part in regulating this axis. And so we can now describe what we call the microbiome gut brain axis. And this has come across in a whole variety of studies in a whole different ways. What we were interested in was just to test, and we're just starting to see whether, if we fed the animals this lactobacillus, whether there would be any changes in behavior, in stress, and then what was driving this in terms of whether it was some of the targets that were known to be implicated in these behaviors. And indeed, we found it. So we went after this looking a little bit to see mechanistically how this could happen, which I think is what your question is. And what we found was that one of the major nerves, the cranial nerve 10, the vagus nerve, which is really very much a relay for monitoring what's going on in all aspects of visceral function to the brain. When this was cut, this nerve, these effects didn't happen. So we know it's happening through a direct mechanism on the vagus nerve, and there is a means for this communication. Hmm. On the same way, when you're, we've known for a long time that if you're feeling sick or you get a bad bacteria, like in a food poisoning, the same nerve will signal to the brain to allow you to express the sickness behavior. So it's kind of like the good side of that of what we've already known.
I've heard physiologists tell me that there are so many nerves in your gut, it's almost like a mini brain center down there.
And it's often referred to that as a small brain. And the enteric system is very important for maintaining all aspects of homeostasis.
Mm-hmm. And so people are going to want to say, of course, and I'm sure you've been asked, should I go out and eat a lot of yogurt with bacteria in it, will it have the same effect?
So what I want to impress on the listeners today is, from this study, is that it's just early days, This is the effects of one specific bacteria, one specific lactobacillus strain. And we're learning a lot about how these bacteria affect health and physiology, but we also know there's lots of differences between the different strains. And so this one isn't one that is currently commercially available in your supermarket, so it's different, although it's not, you know, it's not unrelated to some of the ones that are there, but it is. We haven't tested this one in any human population yet, so I'd be a bit cautious in over extrapolating from this to humans as yet. However, what I think the study shows, and what I think is really important, and why I think it's gaining so much attention, is that it gives us the idea that the concept of treating stress-related disorders by modulating gut microflora can happen, and this can happen in a positive way. So it's encouraging, is what I would say.
You know, we've always heard about food also being very quieting to people, you know, when they're upset. I guess it might work through the same mechanism.
Well, I mean, definitely the vagus plays a role in satiety signaling and other aspects. And indeed, we're interested in our lab here in Cork, we're interested in the interaction between stress and food intake, although it's quite a complex interaction as well.
Why did the bacteria calm the brain down instead of make it more excited?
Okay, well, so what it did was it affected the neuro. What we looked at, it was a neurotransmitter, GABA, and GABA is the main calming inhibitory neurotransmitter in the brain. And what we found was that this bacteria was able to affect the receptors, which are the proteins in the brain that signal the chemicals. So it affected the levels of these receptors. Now, we haven't, there's lots of other receptors and other neurotransmitters, and we haven't looked at this, but we plan to. But it is one of these things that we were quite surprised at, that we were able to get such a pronounced effect, and similar effects as if the animals had been given some pharmaceutical agents that are used to treat anxiety and depression.
So you see, you're saying that the effect was so strong that it was like taking a Valium.
The effects on behavior were very similar to what we would see if we'd given these mice an acute injection of Valium. Yeah.
Wow, that is pretty strong.
It really is, and we were really. Surprised about the robustness. And what was really neat about this is that we carried out these experiments in two different labs, so in my lab and my colleagues in Cork, and also that of the Bean and Stock and Forsyth labs in McMaster in Canada. So we were able to reproduce it in two different sites, which really gave us extra confidence that what we're seeing is real.
Do you think that different strains of different bacteria might have different effects?
Absolutely, and we know that from studies in immunology and on gut function and other aspects of physiology, that there are different responses. Because the key here that we need to really find out is, what is it specific about this bacteria that's causing it to activate the vagus? Is it something that it's releasing? Does it need to be alive to do it? You know, there's lots of studies that we need to figure out. Is there an additive effect independent of the vagus? There's other things that we need to figure out. But what's important to reinforce is that, you know, if it is a metabolite or something that it is secreting, then that might be specific to that bacteria compared to another bacteria.
Mm-hmm. We have a tweet coming in from Jason who says, "What dosage did you use? I'm sure people want to try this themselves."
Oh, well, they won't be able to. I mean, one has to also remember that the what we give to animals is quite different because of their overall physiological differences. So we use doses, chronic dosing over a number of weeks, I think it was like 109 colony forming units of the bacteria was I think what it was. All the details are of the specifics are in the paper, but it's consistent with doses that other people have given to laboratory animals previously. Mm-hmm. But it's very difficult I wouldn't even know how to correlate the doses we would give to animals up to what humans would get.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you go from here?
Well, we really want to find out how this happens. That's really one of the things that we want to know. We want to know, is it, as you asked, is it specific to this bacteria? And you know, would other bacteria do the same thing? And is it only lactobacillus? And it's probably not. Other good bacteria, like bifidobacteria, probably also do similar effects. But it's going to vary from strain to strain and see how it goes. And then finally, of course, we would like to try some type of bacterial intervention and assess, is it a true probiotic in humans?
Yeah, and so you will be doing human testing?
Yeah, I mean, our center in Cork is the Alimentary Pharmabiotics Center. It's very translational, so we do everything from molecule all the way up to human intervention. So this study here would buoy us very much into attempting to try and do this in humans. And there has been some studies in humans with probiotics, although very limited. There was one out of France in the British Journal of Nutrition a few months ago, which was quite encouraging, which had a mixture of two potential probiotics together, which showed that they could affect stress and it could affect mood in a positive sense.
Boy, the drug companies don't want to hear this.
Drug companies, I don't know, but maybe the food companies do.
That's right.
You know, I mean, it's what's really neat about this, and what's important to reinforce as well, is that the mechanism that we're showing in terms of what it's doing to the brain chemistry is the same as what the pharmaceuticals are doing. So it's not undermining the actual biological theories underlying anxiety or depression in any sense. It's just showing that we can modulate them by maintaining good digestive health.
And that's the key, you're saying, good digestive health.
Yeah. Yeah,
and if you do that, the bacteria will take care of themselves.
Well, it's hard to know in terms of cause and effect. We do know that, and studies from our own group have shown that if subjects have early life stress, and also studies from the U.S. has also shown that stress can affect the makeup of your microbiota, gut flora, and the composition of it. And we know that perhaps one of the things that the probiotics are doing in certain situations is kind of working to kind of rebalance any disturbed microbiota composition. However, evidence for that is still not clear, and these studies are ongoing. People are working on trying to basically look for signatures in various patient populations of the gut flora and see how it changes over time and over certain manipulations.
Mm-hmm. Do you expect an influx of money now from the probiotics people to keep
this
going?
I don't know. I mean, hard to know. I mean, as you may know, Ireland is in a tough state for financially, so getting any type of funding for researchers will be very much welcome. We're hoping that this is a very much a conceptual change in people's mind with this paper in terms mm-hmm. of trying to move the idea that you can, by modulating the gut, we can actually have effect behaviors that are previously thought to be largely only to be manipulated by agents that get across the blood-brain barrier into the brain.
Right.
So I think it opens up, and there's a lot of work to do on it, and I'm very excited about it in terms of the potential it might have, and especially in terms of the way it might impact patient care down the way, because some people are more eager to take a food agent than they will be a pharmaceutical.
All right, Dr. Cryan, thank you very much, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
John Cryan, Professor of Anatomy, University of College Cork in Ireland. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. You hear me on the air every week, but do you know what it's like inside our studios? Yeah, you can check out pictures from the studio every Friday at our Facebook page, facebook.com/scifry. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Next up, we're getting into the Wayback Machine, going back 13 billion years ago, near the time of the Big Bang. Because this week, in the journal Nature, astronomers reported the discovery of a very primitive star formed back then when the universe had very few chemical elements, mostly just hydrogen, helium, a little dash of lithium. There's just one little problem with this discovery. The star should not exist, according to one current theory of star formation. But there it is. How did it get there? How did it form? Maybe it's back to the drawing board on our theories. And what about the sun? It was born billions of years later than this early star. How different is it? Well, joining me to talk about this is my guest. She was not involved in the study, but she has found some very old stars herself. We're talking with Anna Friebel, She is a Clay Fellow at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Friebel.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
Tell us what is so unusual about the star.
Well, in order to answer that question, let me just zoom out a little bit and put what you said in my own words. The universe, as you mentioned, consisted only of hydrogen, helium, and a little bit of lithium right at the Big Bang. That's what all was made in the Big Bang. And over time, all the heavy elements we are made of, like carbon and oxygen and iron, they were made over time in stars and supernovae. So the universe only very slowly built up some quantities of these heavier elements. Now, this new star has very little of especially iron and carbon, and so we then believe that the star must have formed very early on in the universe. And it's one of those stars that has one of the very least amounts of iron and carbon that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes it exciting for us. We can look back in time by studying the chemistry in these stars.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't conform to the way we think stars have formed, I understand.
Well, the star formation in the early universe is actually a very big puzzle. Now, we know that star formation today is very complicated, and you would think that in the early universe, when fewer metals and heavy elements existed, it was easier. But, it is easier, but it's not easy. And so there are actually several competing theories for star formation out there. And, we know that these stars exist, and certainly the new one exists. There is some little quibble now with one theory, but there are several other theories that are not touched by the discovery of this star. So we're definitely learning something new here, and I think it's very exciting to have a new star that looks slightly different from, for example, the stars that I have formed. So they're all kind of from similar generations. They're all from the similar family. And they all look a little bit different, and they all tell us something new about how star formation actually might have proceeded.
So can you give us an idea or a guess on how a star like this might have formed then?
Yes. So the very first generations of stars that formed in the universe, those were actually quite massive. They were probably 100 times bigger than the sun, more massive than the sun. And the reason for that is that the primordial material, just the hydrogen and helium, that couldn't really cool down enough. So if you want to make a small star, the gas from which it forms needs to become very cold so it can clump together and essentially make a little ice cube. Now, the smaller your ice cube is supposed to be, your star, the colder it has to get. And in the early universe, for the very first stars, there just wasn't enough cooling there. There weren't enough cooling mechanisms there. Metals such as carbon and oxygen, they act as cooling agents in the gas. They just radiate energy away. If you don't have that, your gas cannot get very cold, and which means you make very big stars. Now, the newly discovered star is most likely even lighter than the sun. So that means you have to get cool the gas in order to make that star before the star can actually form and start its nuclear fusion in the center. And so there are different theories, and this has been going on in the field for several years now. How can we get the gas to cool? And one idea is that carbon and oxygen, the carbon and oxygen atoms, do the job. And there are many stars that support that theory.
So they draw off the heat from the star.
That's from the gas.
From the gas, right.
Right, so it can start forming an ice cube and a clump.
That's counterintuitive to hear that the star has to get colder to get hotter.
Yes. Well, you first have to make the star. So as the gas gets cooler, the gas condenses, clumps together, and gravitation acts on it. And at some point, you kind of have a gas ball there that is dense enough that it can, and then it keeps falling together based on gravity, and that heats it up in the very core, whereas the outsides are still rather cold. And then at some point, nuclear fusion starts to burn and to ignite, and only then we actually call it a star. But you have to get to that stage. You have to make it small enough and dense enough in the center that hydrogen burning, so the hydrogen gets converted to helium, can actually begin.
Mm-hmm. And so are there other particles or dust or whatever out there that can act as the cooling agent instead of
Exactly. So it could not just be carbon and oxygen atoms. It could also be dust grains. And dust grains, of course, consist also of some kind of heavy elements, but they are clustered together in little grains. And those grains can be made in supernovae explosions. For example, the explosions of the very first stars.
Hmm.
And so this material gets created, the dust grains get made, and they get spilled out into the interstellar medium, and they act as cooling agents there as well. And so according to that theory, this new star should well exist, even though there is now a little challenge to this idea that carbon and oxygen atoms are the major cooling channels, the major cooling mechanism to form these low-mass stars in the early universe.
Mm.
But I think, you know, a little controversy is always great. It gets us excited. We will go back to the drawing board, and future conferences, I'm sure, will have a lot of discussions about this. So it's, new data is always exciting, especially when you think about the early universe, which has happened such a long time ago, and these stars are one of the few actual data points we can get from this time back then.
You know, scientists, whether you talk to them about not finding the Higgs boson or not understanding a star formation, they get more excited about the negative results than they do about the positive results.
Yeah, because it definitely rules out things. You know, everyone has lots of ideas on how it happened, and that's great because we want to find out. But we need the data to rule out all these, you know, sometimes more or less crazy ideas. So it really helps to find something that, you know, looks yet a little bit different because it sparks a lot of new ideas.
Yeah.
And hence we can fill in the puzzle of the universe.
if we have in biology biodiversity, what would we call star diversity?
It's definitely chemical diversity.
Chemical diversity.
Because we are studying the chemical abundances in these stars because we believe they have been preserved in the outer layers of the stars since the time of their birth.
As Carl Sagan used to call them, star stuff. We're all made of star stuff.
Yes, we are.
Yeah.
Yes, as I said, all the elements have been made in stars and supernovae. And the clue with this new star, as well as the ones that I have previously found, is that they were right at the beginning of the stuff. So perhaps only one or two generations of supernovae made the very first amounts of heavy elements, and then these little stars formed from the slightly enriched primordial material, and they preserved exactly this chemical fingerprint in their surface and transported it with them until today. And so they are in the Milky Way galaxy today. They're shining right there for us every night. And we use the world's biggest telescopes to observe these fossil stars.
You have one heck of a job. 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Ed in Minneapolis. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Aaron.
Hi there.
Hey, my phone is starting to cut out here. And so just quick, I'm just quite curious. I didn't hear where the star was located at. How old it is, and if it's from the beginning of the universe. How do they really figure that it's from back then?
Okay, good question. Where? How close is it? Where is it? Can we see it? And how old is it?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what the exact coordinates are right now, but it's a reasonably bright star. If you have a small amateur telescope, you can probably see it from your backyard, depending on where you live, you know, northern or southern hemisphere. I think this one is located in the southern hemisphere. It is not too far away. I heard it's about 4,000 light years away, and that for our galaxy kind of means just the beginning of the outskirts. So not too close, not too far away. And
And is it in a constellation we can look toward?
I actually have to admit that I don't know the constellation.
I'd heard it was in Leo.
That is probably true. For us astronomers, we are a little bit geeky. We usually don't really go by the constellations. We have, you know, the coordinates that we dial into our telescope. And
I know, because I read your paper, and it had all the geeky coordinates and didn't tell me how far away it was even in there. And I found...
That is true, yeah. But it's 4,000 light years away.
Let me stop you there. Because, you know, if something is that old near the beginning of the universe, how come it's so close, relatively speaking?
Yeah, that is the beauty of this work with these old stars. If I can just zoom out for a second again, the way we think that large galaxies like the Milky Way form is through a hierarchical assembly. Now, that sounds like a mouthful, but what it means is you start in the early universe with a small galaxy. And it, like a little kid, it wants to grow bigger, and it does so by eating up other, even smaller galaxies and gas and stars and whatever it can find. So it grows and grows and grows and eats up all these smaller systems. And any of these old fossil stars that we're finding, based on their chemistry, we can tell that they're formed in the very early universe, probably in a small galaxy. And then that galaxy was likely eaten up by a bigger one. And so it got deposited into a new bigger one. And then perhaps that one itself got eaten up again by yet another bigger one. And so it slowly made its way over cosmic timescales into the Milky Way, into the outskirts of our galaxy where we see it today.
So we're in the stomach of some other galaxy.
We've definitely eaten up some galaxies. It's actually still happening today. We have evidence of that, too. Huge star streams in the outskirts of the Milky Way. They look very pretty in photos, but it's actually quite a violent process.
Well, Dr. Friebel, this is quite fascinating. I think we all learned a lot about star stuff today, and I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today. And good luck in your work.
Thank you very much. And, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Have a good weekend. Anna Friebel is the Clay Fellow at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics, famous place in Cambridge, Massachusetts. For the rest of the hour, a case study of how genetics is revolutionizing what we know about human history. And in this instance that I'm talking about, the history of the Black Death, the bubonic plague. Modern plague is caused by the bacterium Yersinia pestis, but for decades, scientists and historians have debated whether the medieval plague was indeed caused by this same bug, or was it something else? Maybe it was anthrax or a virus? Well, a study out this week in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences answers some of those arguments. One of my next guests is an author on that paper, and he reports finding DNA evidence of the same bacteria responsible for the plague today in the skeletons of English victims of the Black Plague. But the DNA isn't the whole story. For example, are there still some mysteries around, like, what made the plague so virulent and quick to spread in the 14th century? Was it just a slightly different strain of the bug that we see today? These are great questions. We're going to try to answer them now with my guests. Hendrik Poyner is an evolutionary geneticist at McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Poyner.
Well, thanks for having me, Ari.
You're welcome. Michael McCormick is chair of the Science of the Human Past program at Harvard. Mm-hmm. He's also the Gollett Professor of Medieval History there. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. McCormick.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
You're welcome. You know, we were all taught about the Black Death as kids. You know, it was carried by rats. They had fleas and or whatever, and they infected people. Isn't that not the truth?
Well, there's been a lot of informed debate about that subject right from the outbreak of the third pandemic of plague that's going on right now in the late 1890s in China. Scientists began to identify it with the medieval Black Death. But as knowledge deepened and as scholars went more carefully through the evidence, a number of factors emerged that caused some of them to be more or less skeptical, and through the identification opened for debate. Some argued for a while that rats aren't mentioned in medieval texts at the right time. Others argued that rats weren't found in the archaeological evidence, and plague is first and foremost a disease of rats, and we get it from rodents, and particularly from the black rat. And so there were anomalies that it seemed to appear in the medieval descriptions of some of the symptoms, and so there was a lot of healthy debate about this.
Mm-hmm. Did you say that there's a plague going on now in China?
There's a plague going on now in the United States. It has become the third pandemic of plague began in the late 19th century, reached San Francisco in the 1890s, around 1900, and it's been moving steadily westward, transmitted by squirrels and prairie rats.
No kidding.
Oh, yes. The southwestern United States has a very good public health warning system for plague. Hmm. We have a few cases every year.
Yeah. Hendrik, tell us what you've done here with the DNA.
Well, that's our interest has really been to try and identify sort of larger genetic sections of the DNA from Yersinia pestis embedded in these skeletal remains. And so this has always been a sort of a complex thing because, of course, a skeleton buried in a plague pit that's over 600 years old is, of course, a heavy mixture of the DNAs of bacteria and fungi and the insect and any rodent that may have dug through the pit at that time. And so in addition to the endogenous human DNA that you'll have a tremendous amount of sort of contaminating exogenous DNA. And so we've always been interested in trying to find this needle in the proverbial haystack of DNA sitting there in these skeletal remains.
Mm-hmm. And you did find it.
And we did, yeah, we did. Of course, people have argued that there are other co-circulating pathogens, so that's something, of course, that we would like to continue to look at. With the advent of these high-throughput sequencers now on the market, it's actually a much easier thing to mm-hmm. do. But, mm-hmm. yeah, so we had to really develop a novel method to actually target these few, very few sort of circulating stretches of tiny DNA of the pathogen actually still preserved within the root cavity of the teeth that were still embedded in the jaws that we actually removed from the jaws from these skeletal remains at the British Museum.
All right. We're going to talk more about tracking down the origins of the plague and identifying it today with Hendrik Poyner and Michael McCormick. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. If Science Friday is music to your ears, hey, you ought to try us in Technicolor. We make videos, too. Subscribe to our free video podcast on iTunes or watch them through our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm sure you'll enjoy them. You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking about the history of the plague and tracking down DNA evidence for it to prove that it might be similar to the kind of plague that's still around today. Talking with Hendrik Poyner from McMaster University in Hamilton, Canada, Michael McCormick of Harvard, our number 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to do that. And we were talking about, this was really interesting with Hendrik, about you dug out DNA from the teeth of people buried in the 14th century.
That's right. Yeah.
Where was this?
These were skeletal remains actually excavated in the late 1980s by the British Museum in a pit called the East Smithfield gravesite. And this was actually purchased. We have historical documentation showing the land actually purchased by the king for an additional mass gravesite because the numbers were filling up at the other gravesites too quickly. So he needed additional land to build a pit to bury additional people. I'm sure, Michael, you know much more about this than I do.
Michael, chime in if you'd like.
Wonderful excavation. The Museum of London did a great job of doing the excavation and then preserving the remains and organizing them. In fact, they've put, as Hendrik knows well, they've put them all up on an online database to allow scientists and scholars to have access to.
Yeah,
the
absolutely. They've done an absolutely fantastic job there, and so we were
fantastic.
Yeah, allowed to actually go in, and we thought, well, we'll test the skeletal remains, the actual bones, but then we thought it probably would be a much better thing to target the teeth, because if we can actually get actually still any remaining blood within the root cavity of the teeth, we might have a much better chance of actually catching the pathogen within there, because any biochemist or anybody who studies bones knows that despite the fact that they look quite good coming out of remains, they're actually quite porous. They're like a sponge, and so they always absorb everything, which means that they're highly susceptible to hydrolytic damage, which, of course, is any kind of water. And for molecular structures such as DNA, the last thing you want is moving water back and forth. So these teeth were actually fantastically well-preserved, and my graduate student, Christy Boss, actually removed the teeth from the skulls, drilled into the actual root cavity up into the pulp, removed the pulp, and then put the teeth back into the jaws and then reset the jaws in the skull. So that way we wouldn't actually affect the morphology of the remains.
Well, was there any danger that your graduate student could have gotten sick from the plague by drilling into the teeth?
That's right. Well, that's why I sent my graduate
student. That's why I emphasized that.
I think it's important to know that ancient DNA is what they call denatured. It's broken down.
That's right. We assume it's highly degraded.
In large part comes with dealing with, which the new technology permits, dealing with these tiny, tiny base pairs. I think the size of the genome of Yersinia pestis, our bacterium, is about 2 million. Is that right, Hendrik?
Well, the chromosome is about 4.5 million, and then there's these extracellular plasmids that are, they range from 10 to about 100,000 base pairs in length.
And you were working with base pair, set sequences of 40 or 50 base pairs.
That's right. That's right. We literally had 30 to 40 base pair stretches, which is tiny, tiny, tiny.
Well, then how can you make the, and you come to your conclusion with such, with DNA in such bad shape, that it is the same black plague that we have today?
Well, that involves the new technology that we sort of describe, and the methodology we describe in the paper is we're able to actually, so what you can do is you can actually, we can take the sequences on the available databases for the modern pestis strains, and we can artificially create what we like to call, or what we describe to our students in the lab, like a type of fishing line that actually has a set of complementary DNA pieces on this fishing line that, of course, match perfectly the modern Yersinia pestis, one of the Yersinia pestis strain. And then what we do is we actually float that fishing line into this massive pooled extract of everything I told you about. So the actual pathogen is there at very, very low frequency, and then all the additional bacteria, human DNA, everything else that you don't want to catch. And under the right conditions, which are temperature and salt conditions, you can actually get your DNA of your pathogen to actually bind to this fishing line. That fishing line is actually itself attached to proteins, which can then attach to magnetic beads, which then we can use a magnet to pull that fishing line back out, thereby enriching only for the pathogen DNA and not for all the rest of the co-circulating fragments that are polluting your extract.
Mm-hmm. Michael, how did the Black Death spread so fast?
That's a remarkable story, too. So it actually got started from one of the earliest cases of biological warfare, when the Mongols were besieging an Italian colony on the Black Sea in modern-day Ukraine, and they were not getting anywhere, and the plague broke out in their camp. So they catapulted bodies of cadavers of those who died from the plague into the Italian fortress, the Genoese, and it broke out there, and it sailed back to Europe. It affected not only the Genoese, but the rats in the colony, and they boarded the ships, and with the ships of the Genoese and then the Venetian traders, which were binding together this pulsating European economy, as the European economy was reaching toward its peak, its medieval peak in the 14th century, they carried the disease with them to every port they went to. And we can track the outbreaks as they're reported in archival records, and you really get an X-ray of the shipping schedules of the great merchants of medieval Europe as they sailed out from the Black Sea down to the Mediterranean, and then clockwise out into the Atlantic, up into the Baltic, and distributed it in that fashion.
So I think it's interesting that the rate at which it spread leads a lot of people to believe that, I mean, there are those that believe that it's not Yersinia because it moved too quickly to be a plague-like outbreak. And those who do believe it's Yersinia, it was like a pneumonic form, right? So it was then eventually transmissible person to person via air, right?
You have to distinguish between long-distance transmission and close-transmission. The long-distance transmission very clearly follows the shipping schedule.
And just to make sure that people are not panicking now, there is antibiotics that do work against modern plague,
that's right? That's
right.
If you're diagnosed with plague immediately, antibiotics will fix you very quickly.
Right. And did
Don't
you
delay, though.
Yeah. Did you find evidence of the rats where you found the bodies for the plague?
So we haven't actually specifically targeted that, but that's a very interesting and important question. Of course, you know, Bernie Sloan made a very good argument in his recent book that we don't find extensive preservation of rat skeletons in many of these sites, and maybe that has something to do with the preservation abilities of the actual rat body as opposed to a human body. But
well, I can address that if you wish.
Go ahead.
I mean, that's an argument that was started in the 1950s because archaeologists were not turning up rats. The first rats were discovered in the late 80s, in fact, in London. And the reason they weren't turning up rats is if you've ever excavated with a trowel, rat bones are extremely small. and the chance of turning them up with a trowel are almost zero. In order to find rats, you have to sieve with very fine meshes, and it'll take you, two summers ago I was doing it and found a nice rat jawbone. It can take you with a quarter of a millimeter mesh, which is what you need to reliably find rat bones, it will take you an hour or two to do a liter of soil.
Well,
so
this actually,
very,
we should then use sediment, the exact same sediment, Michael, to actually screen it for the DNA of the rat.
Now we have a database that you can consult online of many hundreds of archaeologically documented rat bones from the 3rd century B.C. up to the 16th, 17th century.
Let me
they are all in the right places now.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Alice in Pacifica, California. Hi, Alice. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi. I'm wondering if the guests have read Samuel Cohn's work, for example, June 2002, American Historical Review, in a book he's written, who conclusively, I think pretty convincingly, argues that the Black Death was not bubonic plague, having nothing to do with rats and so forth. And he assembles a big database of, you know, the epidemiology just does not match bubonic plague at all. It hit at the wrong time of the year. The mortality was very different. People acquired immunity. That's why in the 1370s, most people who died were infants and young children, because the earlier generation in 1348 had acquired an immunity. He's pretty sure it's viral, but he doesn't know what it is. So if the Black Death was just not bubonic plague at all, and in fact was viral and not a bacillus,
all right, let me get a reaction, Michael.
I've read Dr. Cohn's work and I'm familiar with it, and I knew his teacher, and it was teacher David Herlihy, my predecessor in the Department of History here at Harvard, was the first to throw out that in very tantalizing fashion some very stimulating questions which challenged aspects, notably of the epidemiology. But I'm satisfied from my own personal study of the materials that while it's worthwhile to challenge these questions, the epidemiology of as reported from the medieval sources, certainly corresponds to my understanding of epidemiology, particularly as delineated by the World Health Organization and the Indian Plague Commission. And I think that the ancient DNA evidence, this is now the second or third positive result of the DNA presence of Yersinia pestis from top, very well-regarded ancient DNA labs. Mm-hmm. And I think now we've reached the point of pretty much conclusion on this part of the debate. Now, there may well have been probably were other infections that occurred at the same time. But the presence and the role of Yersinia pestis for the Black Death, for the medieval plague, we still don't know about the Justinianic plague that played such a big role in bringing down the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. But for the Black Death of the Middle Ages, I think that this part of the debate is closed, and I think it's time to move on to another one.
Well, let's move on to that debate about the Justinian. Why do we know so little about that?
Because there's been very little work done on it, and that broke out in 542, in one of the Roman Empire's great ports, and moved from there all around the empire. The problem is that that plague was so devastating, and remember that the first outbreak is just the beginning of these pandemics. The medieval plague ran into the early 18th century. The Justinianic plague started in 542 and went to 750. It came back, I think, about 15 times over that 200-year period, each time killing between a third and two-thirds of the population.
Wow.
What happened was that the lights go out. We lose the number of records being generated by the Roman Empire. Diminishes tremendously after 542, and so it becomes very, very difficult to follow the events in the written sources. That means that archaeology, that means the kind of molecular archaeology that Hendrick and his team and that of the results of Stephanie Hensch in October and that Mark Ockman are working on, that kind of molecular archaeology really has to be the first line of approach now.
Hendrick, are there any places you could look for?
Sure. No, there are remains of that outbreak.
Is the DNA viable? If you found any?
Yeah. No, that's an important million-dollar question that there are several groups, including ours, looking at. So that's obviously the first really place to go right now is using a very similar type of enrichment strategies actually to acquire the entire genome of Yersinia pestis that caused this outbreak, and then really trying to identify specific mutations within that genome to be able to say something about the increased virulence, or whether or not it wasn't, and whether or not what we're looking at is really a syndemic model of infection with many co-circulating things, and it was just happened to be a perfect storm, right? Mm. We know. Mm.
Let me just remind everybody, I have to just jump. Gentlemen, I just got to jump in here for a second and remind everybody that this is Science Friday from NPR. Sorry, we're all very excited about talking about it.
Mutations change over space and time, so that it would be theoretically possible, as indeed was argued in the October paper in PLOS pathogens, that one can actually detect different variants of the genome of the disease as it moves through the population. So you could say that this person died at the beginning of the outbreak, this person died at the end. You could say that this person died in the third wave, this person died in the fifth wave, which would just be a radical transformation in our knowledge of the historical epidemiology of this terrible disease, and of course of the shipping and communications that made it happen.
Let's go to the phones. One, let's see if we can get a call in here from Juan in San Antonio. Hi, Juan.
Hello.
Hi there.
I just had a quick question. Basically, since the plague, at least Yersinia pestis, when it's related to flea bites, it takes a while to incubate, but it does kill you quickly. What do you all suggest that transformed it from the flea-ridden plague to the pulmonary plague, which is a hemorrhagic pneumonitis that tends to kill people in 24 hours. If you can shed some light on that.
So you think it might have transformed into a different one? And so that's why
I'm worried about that, because the vector, the way it transmits is very different.
Yeah.
And also the way it eventually takes its toll on the human body.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, pneumonia-wise, it's just basically hemorrhagic pneumonitis.
Okay.
Destroys the capillaries and infiltrates the lungs.
Let me get a quick answer. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of really, hence why I keep sort of emphasizing that really the next step is acquiring an entire genomic analysis, and it doesn't seem impossible using this type of sort of enrichment technology to get that. And with that information, hopefully then one has a better idea as to, are there specific genes that have been modified, or are there upstream or downstream regulators that have changed to add expression levels of certain proteins, which might explain this increased virulence and rapid transmission.
Mm-hmm. I got about a minute left, but I want to get an interesting fact in here. I know talking about Hendrik, how does a flea actually transmit the plague?
Well, that's interesting. So the once it becomes infected with Yersinia pestis, the bacteria starts replicating its gut and causes a regurgitation of everything, the blood meal that the flea takes. And so the flea becomes increasingly panicked and hungry and transfers from host to host. And each time it takes a new blood meal, it regurgitates thousands and thousands of bacteria that have been replicated within the flea back into this new wound within the individual. So it's actually regurgitating its previous meal, which of course contains the Yersinia pestis, thereby transmitting it to the human. And then, of course, it jumps onto another host and so on and so forth.
Let me talk a little bit in the minute we have left about what you called the modern plague. Is it really a plague, or is it just a few cases of plague in the Southwest? Michael?
It's well under control in the Southwest. It is endemic among prairie dogs, and because there is an excellent public health organization of surveillance there, it is under control. One can easily imagine that when the institutions that keep an eye on our public health are in jeopardy, it could once again get out of control. The last great outbreak, it breaks out regularly in India and Madagascar still today, and there are great efforts to enhance the public health efforts there. Wars and upheavals are usually very good things for Yersinia pestis because they disrupt the institutions that keep an eye on it.
And so does tax cuts, I imagine.
Yeah, for example.
Yeah, when you don't have enough money to take care of local health systems.
This is public health.
Yeah. Thank you, gentlemen. Quite interesting. Thank you very much for taking time to talk with us.
Oh, well, thanks for having us.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. Hendrik Poyner is an evolutionary geneticist at the Michael DeGroote Institute for Infectious Disease Research and the Department of Anthropology at McMaster University in Hamilton, and Michael McCormick, chair of the Science of Human Past program at Harvard in Cambridge. He's also the Gullett Professor of Medieval History there.